We got a little video. Thank you, team. We got a little video for you guys to watch, but I'm just going to let everybody get off the stage so everybody has a chance to watch it. I got a joke for you guys. This is my funny jokes that my kids groaned at. I saw it on Facebook, so maybe it's not that funny. And I don't even remember because you guys know I'm not very good at telling stories either. So, I ate a Wookiee the other day. Does everybody know what a Wookiee is? From Star Wars? What? It's a giant Sasquatch. I ate a Wookiee the other day. It was Chewy. That's a fantastic joke. That's why my kids say, no, you're not funny. Ella, would you show that video, please? Oh, wait, push backtrack one.
The father of a little girl stuck in the Dominican Republic.
Just go to the previous slide to the announcements.
Finally came face to face with the prime minister today. He flew
click
into
on announcements
Hamilton just for the chance to plead.
There we go. So, you're going to have to watch that again. I apologize. So, I wanted to take a brief second and just kind of reintroduce. So, Vaden Earl is a humanitarian worker. We're not here to build up his accolades. He's here for his story. But Vaden is a humanitarian worker that's done a good work all around the globe, encouraging people to be leaders and step out in boldness, act in faith. He started an organization called Live Differently, Hero Holiday, which became Live Differently. And he's probably going to talk a little bit about that in a story. I don't even know what he's going to talk about, so I shouldn't put words in his mouth. That's how I come too, right? It's a surprise what I'm going to say. And sometimes it works out, sometimes my wife smacks me across the back of the head. So we're going to show a little video, and then Vaden's going to come on up and just share a bit of what's happening with him. So do you guys just mind watching this video?
The father of a little girl stuck in the Dominican Republic due to years of red tape finally came face to face with the prime minister today. He flew into Hamilton just for the chance to plead their case, hoping for Justin Trudeau's help in getting little Wydleen home.
Hi, great to see you guys.
Prime Minister Trudeau got his usual rock star welcome at the annual Winona Peach Festival in Hamilton today. But at this event, he was confronted by a desperate father who's been struggling to bring his adopted daughter, Wydleen, to Canada from the Dominican Republic for fully 8 years. Today, after this exchange, he feels a bit more hopeful.
What a pleasure to see you.
Thank you very much. I heard you guys just filled out some papers in Dominican Republic.
No, it's in
Ottawa.
On that side, the Ottawa stuff too, but there's also stuff going on the Dominican side,
yeah,
right?
It's been shipped to Ottawa.
Good. Excellent. We're keeping our eye on it.
I appreciate your work.
You know that.
I believe it.
You've got people activated across the country.
The whole
country
is behind us.
Oh, yeah, no, you know that. And we're working really hard with you guys.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're getting done.
Vaden Earl hasn't felt so positive towards the Prime Minister in the past. City News brought you his story earlier this year. Earl and his wife adopted Wydleen when she was 4, after her impoverished mother, who was Haitian, died. Wydleen became stateless. And because of a series of events, the adoption was delayed, and eventually Wydleen had to go into hiding, thanks to a Dominican crackdown on refugees. Earl has been working all this time to bring Wydleen to Canada, but says the government has done little to help.
Justin Trudeau and this government were elected on promises. One of those promises was to open the door and help people get to Canada for a better life. Where's that promise today? They're running from us. Minister Hussein is hiding from us. He won't even take our calls.
Wydleen is now 12, and her father says she's living in fear of being rounded up by Dominican soldiers and deported. She has been anxious to get to Canada to see snow and play soccer, but she too has been disappointed in Trudeau.
I was excited when Justin Trudeau was elected because he said he was going to help bring people to Canada.
Earl has appealed to the Canadian public to confront the PM whenever possible about Wydleen's plight.
Mr. Prime Minister, is Wydleen Earl worth human rights to you?
What's that, sir?
Wydleen Earl. I know you know who she is. Yes. Is she worth human rights to you?
Is she worth human rights?
Yes, she has no human rights right now. She's a stateless little girl in Dominican trying to come to Canada.
Well, I will look into the case.
Today, Vaden Earle says Ottawa has all the proper documentation to grant Wideline a temporary residence permit and hopes the Prime Minister will keep his word and help make it happen.
He seems sincere today. He says he's going to get on it, and he was under the impression he didn't have the paperwork. Now he knows it's in his office. I have no choice but to believe him at this point.
Now, one of the reasons for the long delay was back in 2010. All of Wideline's documents were lost and her caseworker killed in the massive earthquake that shook Haiti.
All right. You ever say something on national TV and realize how ridiculous it was a year later? That's me when I said I trusted Justin Trudeau. How ridiculous was that? So that was a year ago, a year and a month ago. I'm going to go down as the biggest idiot in Canadian history. I know it. There's going to be books written about me, and they're going to sing songs about me. I took a promise from Justin Trudeau, and then I went out and bought a house that I still can't live in a year later. Awesome. Let me just get this turned right side up. Not like I'm going to actually say anything in the notes I scrawled down a half hour ago, but let's put them there just so it looks like I'm going to say something. Dave said he likes to do things differently to keep you guys on your toes. Well, I'm here. Hello, toes. this is just a practical question. It has nothing to do with what I'm going to talk about. Is this a new building or a newer building or a renovation or something?
New renovation.
Okay. Because I think I spoke in this church about 25 years ago. Not here, but in town there was a church that I spoke at. Okay. All right. I was less bald, less fat, less hairy. I don't know. I was a lot of things. Didn't have this on my face, so no one would remember me anyways. So that's my daughter, Wideline. You saw her in the video earlier. So I'm going to give you a little bit of background on our situation. And our situation is why I'm in Canada right now. But it wasn't easy getting here today. I did a bit of a milk run to get here. I think I ended up in 6 different airports, and as Dave mentioned, I drove through the night last night from Edmonton to get here. Just me and the freezing rain and the deer, it was great. A lot of fun. My wife, Nikki, bought me some snacks for the road, and I really like spicy stuff, and she bought me a big bag of super spicy hot rods. So I'm like, great, but I forgot to pick up water or any liquid of any sort. And when you leave Edmonton at 3 in the morning, once you leave the Henday, there's nothing. Like, really nothing until Wainwright, I guess, is the first thing that was open. I was on fire. Anyways, so the situation is this. We adopted Wideline 2009, and the way it came about was really, really bizarre. As Dave mentioned, I actually lived in Saskatchewan for 6 years. I went to Central. What year did you go there, Dave?
97, 98.
So you weren't kidding when I was older than you. I thought that was a joke. I look way younger than you. Yeah, I was graduating then. Yeah, okay. So I moved to the big, thriving metropolis of Shelbrook, Saskatchewan. Big city, and started as youth pastor there, and really quickly went on a couple international trips and recognized that our calling wasn't necessarily just local, but it was going to be more international. So we started an organization. We moved down to the Toronto area, not because I like Toronto or the Leafs or anything silly like that, just because being in the center of the population as far as doing something internationally, it just made sense. And started an organization. And I started doing some international travel, and on one trip, I ended up realizing something, and I realized that those World Vision commercials that we see on TV, those are real people. That's not just, you know, something to make us all sad and give money. People, Not just a few people are living that way, but most of the world is living that way. The majority of the world lives like those commercials. We are not the rule. We are the exception. And I realized that. And so I started this organization, me and my wife, and we called it Hero Holiday. And we start taking just large numbers of Canadian and American youth to developing countries to do humanitarian projects. And it grew really quickly. The first year we thought we'd take 30 or 40 kids, and 150 signed up. The next year 500, the next year 1,500, and a few years later we had already taken 10,000 students to six different countries and built like 500 houses or some crazy thing. So it blew up. I'm going to read you one page of this book, and I'm here to talk about Woodlean's story. But I got to read you this, because if you don't understand why I ended up where I ended up to meet her, then none of it will make any sense. Is that all right if I do that? So this is a book that I wrote in 2007. Yes, I wrote a book. Okay, don't look at me like that. I know some of you are thinking, has he ever read a book? But look, lots of pictures. So it's not as hard to believe anymore, right? You guys will all know, because you're all going to buy a copy of this today anyway, so probably most of you buy three or four, with Christmas right around the corner and all. Oh, by the way, while I'm looking for my page, because I somehow lost where I put it, when I left Dominican Republic 3 days ago, it was 32 degrees. I got to Kingsville, Ontario, where I bought the house, thank you, Mr. Trudeau, and it was 31 degrees in Kingsville, Ontario. Then I got on a plane and landed in Edmonton. Think you know how that story ends. I look pretty good with my flip-flops and my shorts. Wow. Okay, so I'm going to read you this, and it's going to set the stage for everything else I say this morning. I'm not wearing a watch, so too bad. I don't know how long I'm going to talk. I'll try not to be too long because I'm a little hungry. I'm going to read this, and I apologize in advance, because there's probably a really good chance this story is going to ruin your day. So I've warned you. If you don't want your day ruined, plug your ears. Sukan will break your heart. She's an 8-year-old Cambodian girl sold by her parents to help pay the expense of raising the rest of the family. Taken out of Cambodia into Thailand along with another little girl, she was sold yet again. New owners and a fake passport got them to Toronto's Pearson International Airport and through customs. I'm going to pause there. When I read this story, this was a BBC World News article. I later published it in my book. When I read this story, it's important to know, I lived within sight of Toronto Pearson Airport. So what I'm about to read happened in my neighborhood. That's why this jumped out to me, because of that. That's the reason I'm prefacing that. And I've lost my spot. Toronto Pearson Airport and through customs. After a day, now remember, 8 and 9 years old. After a day of pornographic photography, they sat on a stool and they watched a dozen white men pull cash from their wallets and pass to their owner. The two who ponied up the highest amount got the honor of deflowering the two virgin children. After being robbed of their childhood by the two wealthiest men, the little girls were subjected to a series of rapes that lasted through the night. The next morning, they were taken across the Windsor border. Windsor's where I live now. Well, I don't live, I have a house there, into the United States. Stripped, each woman was given a number on her back right shoulder blade with a black felt marker and pushed into a large room in the backstage of a nightclub. They weren't alone. Sukan and her partner were overwhelmed by the sight of 19 8 to 10-year-olds, all naked, all numbered with black felt markers. This night was to be a slave auction. After being paraded out in a cattle call and submitting to a litany of instructions, jump, turn, bend over, strike alluring poses, the two were herded backstage. Then each one was brought out alone to be auctioned off. Sukan was reserved to the very end. She was told that the health of her family and even her own future prospects hinged entirely on her performance. She determined to excel. She danced, hopped, twisted, turned like her very life depended on it. A heated bidding war escalated. Sukan tried even harder, spiraling, arching, bending, smiling, anything to improve her value. Finally, the auctioneer called those time-honored words, going once, going twice, sold. Sukan's 8-year-old life was hawked for $42,000, the highest price ever paid for a prostitute at that site. 8 years old. So I read that in a newspaper. To get from Toronto airport to Windsor, unless these guys are crazy, they would have gone down the 401 right by my living room. Because I always thought this stuff happened around the world. I thought this is something, this happens over there. And over there is the problem of someone else. Now all of a sudden they're driving down the road in front of me, and over there is now right here, and that's a problem. So I did what any logical person would do. I booked the flight to Cambodia, and I flew there, and I went to the very place where they were sold. And I thought, this is media sensationalizing this. This can't not possibly be as bad as the article makes it out to be. This has to be just blown up for the newspaper. And I was partly right. It certainly wasn't accurate, because what I saw when I got there was about 10 times worse than what the newspaper said. It was unbelievable. Children were being sold like trinkets and put on the backs of trucks and shipped like you put, like, you know, sheep on the back of a truck, and just, they're going over to Kindersley, they're going over to PA, just like that. Same kind of trucks, the whole deal. Children. I couldn't believe it. I came back home, and we launched into a whole new thing with our organization because of this story, because of this. So that's why you heard that today. And we started going into some of the little more aggressive places. We didn't just do mission trips and vacation Bible schools. We went to the places where the crap was happening, pardon my French. One of our trips was to Dominican Republic, and one of the issues in DR, as you're going to hear a little more about, are that there's a lot of Haitian illegals and refugees that have crossed over the border and are working in DR, but it's not a good situation. Every garbage dump outside of every city in Dominican Republic has got a couple hundred Haitians living in it, like living in the garbage dump. They live there because when we go there to the all-inclusive and we go to the buffet and we think we need 16 pancakes for breakfast and realize we only needed 12, those four get scraped into the garbage, they go all the way to the landfill, and those 100 Haitians have food. And that's the cycle. That's how it works. They live in the garbage dumps so they can get scraps from the all-inclusives, from the tourists, and maybe some plastics to recycle or to sell. Possibly somebody threw out a watch or something that's of some sort of value. That's how they live. We were going to there for years, and it became normal. Is that terrible that just became normal, that we just roll up and just see it, and our trucks would roll up? And one day, however, one lady stood out to me. Her name was Mary Therese, and she didn't look normal. I mean, most of the people in the dump are women. The men in that generation have mostly all died. They live a short life cutting sugarcane. It's a terrible life. A lot of them just didn't make it. So the majority of the people that are working are the women. Mary Therese stood out because she had a little tiny infant on her arm. Now, I'm not talking about a nice Canadian garbage dump. Like, I used to go with my father-in-law and snoop around the garbage dump and see if I could find any treasures, you know, an old guitar or a bed frame or something, I don't know, some copper that we could sell. This is not that. This is not that at all. There's no standards. So, I mean, the hospitals dump all the medical waste in the same place that the all-inclusives dump all the pancakes. It is a mess. And when people are walking around, they don't have a long life expectancy because the stuff just gets burnt and they're inhaling all the smoke and the fumes and everything else. So this lady holding this little infant really stood out. I mean, she stuck out. So I came over. We had a group of about 80 kids at the time on this trip. And I'm not going to lie to you, I've been doing them trips for a long time at this point. And I'm like, let's let the teenagers do the hard work. I'm okay with, you know, the photo op or whatever. So let the kids do the work. And I said, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to man the water station. Because it's hot. And you get a bunch of Canadian teenagers, you know, who are used to this. and put him in 40 degrees in the middle of the day with no shade, no trees, and a bunch of toxic smoke, you got to keep him hydrated. So we used to set up a little tent with cold water station. We just cranking out the cold water. And we tell him every 10 minutes, you come and smash a glass of cold water just so you don't, even if you're not thirsty. I said, I'm gonna man the watering station. I can crank that lever all day long. And I went over to Mary Therese, this lady, and I said, give me that kid. She's going to come and do the water station with me. Because I didn't want this little child to be inhaling all this nastiness, right? So here we go. We're doing our watering station as I drink my water. That was not planned. We're doing the watering station. And I got to be honest. I'm not going to try and pretend I'm like Gandhi or something. I really didn't like kids that much. You know, they made noises, they cried, they, you know, didn't like them. They puked on me and stuff. And maybe just because they didn't like me. But I fell in love with this little kid. I mean, I just attached to her. We didn't know her name. She had a chronic sinus infection, so she always had like a snotty nose. So our teenagers, our team, nicknamed her Snotball. So for years, we didn't know her name. She was just Snotball. And we watched her go from infant to toddler to, you know, whatever comes after toddler. And just we'd roll up in our trucks to this little community by the garbage dump. And she'd be the first one that would run out. And I'd grab this kid and we'd go to the watering station. We'd bring gifts and clothes. And just it's just one of those things where you go to a place long enough, eventually you're going to connect with people. And this was the kid that we connected with. So fast forward a couple of years. She was about 4 and a half. And I was in Hamilton, Ontario, where I lived at the time. And believe it or not, I was in a meeting with my local MP. I've always been involved in politics. I know. Just shake your head at me. I know. Of all the things to be involved in. But I've always been heavily involved in politics. I forgot to say something. I was speaking with Kelly Block, your MP, who was going to come, but she's stuck in Ottawa doing some stuff. She was actually going to be here today, but Kelly says hi. She's helping us with this. She's become a close friend, and really, she's dug into this. So, you got a good one here. Anyways, that wasn't a political plug. She didn't ask me to make a political plug, but I'm just saying hi. So, I was involved in politics, and I met with my MP, who I will not be making a political plug for today. And while meeting with this guy, I got a phone call, and it was one of our kids on the Hero Holiday trip, and she said, we can't find Snotball. I'm like, what do you mean you can't find Snotball? He said, well, Snotball and Mary Therese aren't at the garbage dump. They're not there anymore. I said, well, can you kind of look into it and see what's going on? Because that's a bit off. She just wants to play the drums. No big deal. I was thinking of doing the same thing. So anyways, long story short, she looked into it and found out that this lady had died. Mary Therese had passed away. And this little girl went to the care of her grandmother. And her grandmother already had a bunch of grandkids and kids to feed. Too many mouths to feed. So she sent this little girl back to Haiti. And in Haiti, orphans, there's only one fate for an orphan in Haiti. And they get sold to, I can't say wealthy families, I'm going to say less impoverished families. And they get sold as household servants. So this 4 and a half year old was for sale in Haiti. She was about to be going out and doing dishes and cleaning the car at 4 and a half, sweeping the floors, that kind of thing. So at that point, my wife was there on the ground, and she says, what do you want to do? And I'm literally sitting in a room with my local MP. So I said, hang on. And I said, Dave, can you help us? With what? I said, well, there's this kid. We fell in love with her, and I haven't even cleared this by the wife yet, but I think we should adopt her and bring her here. We got to go find her in Haiti. I just told him the whole story. He goes, yep. And he got literally pulled out his phone and called the Minister of Immigration at the time and got him on the phone. So I had the connections to do this, and they had a little call, and yep. Tell him, go ahead. It's going to cost about $5,000 in legal fees. She'll be here in 12 weeks. Done. All right, go find her. So I got on a plane, went down, went to Haiti. It took us 2 and a half weeks. We found her and brought her back to Dominican Republic. And something happened that kind of screwed up everything. Earthquake, 2010. All of our paperwork was lost. Our caseworker was killed. It was like she was never born. And the Canadian government said, without all that proof, we can't help you anymore. So now we've got a little girl that we've moved from Haiti to Dominican, living in our house. And the Canadian government says, sorry, we can't bring her to Canada. What do you do? So that's our story. That's Woodleen. The fast forward now, 2 years ago, and we kind of thought, we're going to live in Dominican Republic. We're going to be there till she's 18. She'll apply as an adult. She'll come to Canada. Who cares? And my recommendation is this, and it's very relevant today. If you're going to get stuck in a country because you're adopting a kid, get stuck in a country with good beaches, right? Like, I mean, that's the way to do it. So I wasn't I was complaining that I had to wait 10 years. I wasn't complaining very loudly. You know, it's like, okay, we're going to live on a postcard. 2 years ago, though, something changed. Dominican Republic said, we don't want any more Haitians in our country. So they changed the law. Anyone, even if they were born in Dominican Republic, even if they had a Haitian passport, even if they had a Haitian or a Dominican passport or citizenship, they're being deported. But they weren't like, not like in Canada where it's like go to a hearing and fill out the paperwork and get on a plane. They were driving down the streets, 80 and 100 soldiers with AR-15 rifles and grabbing everybody with black skin, throwing them in the back of a caged bus and taking them and dumping them at the border. In 1 year, 1,200 children were dumped at the border unaccompanied, no adults. That's what was happening. Amnesty International said it's the biggest humanitarian crisis in the history of the Western Hemisphere. Yet, we all go there for vacation. That's what's happening. So we started the campaign to bring Woodleen home. We started fighting the Canadian government. We started fighting the Dominican government. So I'm not the most wanted. I didn't make the top of the most wanted list in Dominican Republic yet. I'm probably the top of the most hated list in Dominican Republic. I've been on national TV like this 100 times talking about the racist legislation there. They started with coming into my business and sticking a gun in my face and telling me if you keep protecting Haitians, we're going to kill you. Then they arrested me a couple of times. Then four of them gave me a pretty solid beat down one time. In my defense, I put up a pretty good fight. So now we moved. We live in a hotel. We move every 2 weeks. We move to a different place so they can't stay ahead of us. I never fly at the same airport 2 times in a row. Like, they're looking right now because apparently a 13-year-old girl is a huge threat to national security. And that's what we're dealing with. And the Canadian government, you saw Trudeau say, okay, we're going to get it done. I've pretended that didn't happen now. So that's where we're at. So that's why I'm traveling the country, telling the story of Woodleen. We're trying to raise some awareness, raise some money, and try and just get her somewhere safe. 3 days ago, is it Sunday? It must be Sunday. We're in church. That was an easy one. So Wednesday, I was driving home from school with Woodleen, and there was a roadblock with, I counted 32 soldiers. I had to drive off the road, through a fence, through a field, to get away from these guys. And it's only because my SUV was bigger than their SUV that I got away from them. That was it. That's the world we're living in. It's 2018. Can you believe that? Can you believe we're hiding from the police in 2018 and our government's not helping? So that's why I'm traveling around talking about this right now. But it's a Sunday morning and it's church and you're not only going to hear about me. I'm sorry. The reason you're not is because Woodleen is one kid who happens to have an extremely stubborn father. How many thousands of kids don't have a voice? How many millions of kids don't have someone running around doing what I'm doing right now? So let me tell you how everything changed. And I'm going to tell you this, and then I'm going to make a couple points, and then I'll be done. This is how it changed. I was touring around. And I had known Woodleen. I had been to Cambodia. I had seen where Sukan was sold. I had read the story. I'd done it all. But I was touring around. My book had just gone bestseller. when I would go out on the speaking circuit, if someone would call me to go speak, the minimum was $10,000 for me to just to show up and talk. Because I was in demand at the time, right? And that's what I did for a living. I toured around. Our organization was in 6 different countries, and we had about 60 full-time employees. This is what was happening. I was at a conference in Vancouver, and I don't know, it was a couple thousand people. And I, for some reason, I don't know why, I don't know what got into me, but for some reason, I went a little harder than normal. Now, when I'm talking to these teenagers and these college kids, and it's nice for me to talk to a bunch of people of faith, because a lot of times I was in universities and colleges talking to atheists, and they're looking at me like I got 6 heads, and it's a different angle, it's a different conversation, right? So it's kind of nice when I know I can say things that we all understand the same language here today. But I'm standing up, and I was touring, and I was doing this, and I was pushing on these kids. You got to do something. What are you willing to give up? What would happen if you had an opportunity to save somebody's life? What would you give up for? And that was my line. That was my thing. I would challenge people, and they would go and they go on and do cool things with their life, and I was happy doing that. Until that night in Vancouver. For some reason, I came on stage, and I was in a mood. I don't know why I was in a mood, but I was in a mood, and I pushed harder than I ever had. And I was right. I mean, I was, and there's 2,000 or 3,000 people in the stadium, and I'm like, come on, really? What? Think about it. Write it down. What are you going to do? What would you do if you had an opportunity to go out and do something and literally to save someone's life? What would it be? And I walk backstage, and I heard the little nudging, a little voice in my head say, oh, you're going to eat those words. And I'm like, crap. I hate when I eat my own words. A month later, we found out that Woodleen's mom had died. A month later. And I'm sitting with that MP, and I'm going, I remembered Vancouver. You see, we're here, and the songs that were chosen this morning were great. Nobody knew what I was talking about, so that we didn't conspire. We didn't conspire, right? No conspiracy. If you're going to make a faith declaration, and listen, if you haven't heard another word I said yet, start listening now. If you're going to make a faith declaration about doing something in your life, before you do it, stop just for a second and realize that when those words come out of your mouth, they better be for life. Don't be flippantly getting all emotional because the lights are dim and the worship is great and the song is good and there's a, you know, an inflex in the music and I'm going to go and save Africa. Don't say it. Because you might end up doing it. If you're going to make a faith declaration, please, for the love of all that is holy, count the cost first. I didn't. I was a motivational speaker, for Pete's sake. I was pushing everybody. I was antagonizing everybody to go out and change the world. And I thought I was changing the world, too. Like, you want to know what world changed? When I was running around charging 10 grand to speak for half an hour and selling 300 or 400 books a day, let me tell you what world changed. I went to Dominican Republic to pick up my daughter and bring her to Canada. I went there on the 15th of January, 2010, to pick her up and bring her to Canada. I even bought her a snowsuit. I brought it with me. Still haven't brought her to Canada. That's the world that changed. And I look back now and I go, if I knew then, yeah, if I knew then, I was going to say that backwards for a second. Would I know now? Would I do it differently? The answer is no, I wouldn't. But in the middle of some of that stuff, I would have changed my mind in a heartbeat. So if you're going to make a faith declaration, you gotta know you're in it to win it. Okay, so now let me say something to you. I want to read you a passage of scripture. It's on my phone. Don't judge me. I'm not checking Twitter. This is just really portable. James 1:27, you all know what it says. Don't even worry about going there. Religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless is this: to look after orphans and widows in their distress and to keep yourself from being polluted by the world. Pure religion, looking after orphans and widows. So I'm going to tell you two things today. What time are we normally done here, by the way, just so I know? Now? Okay. My phone's on some other time zone, so I don't even know what's going on. I haven't switched it over, so I had an excuse. So it's actually 2 o'clock on my phone right now. We're late. I'm going to tell you two things. Maybe just one. Maybe I'll tell you one thing. When I was traveling around speaking at churches all the time, everybody was chasing the elusive revival. We were all chasing it. We got to get to the presence of God and the face of God. And you know, whatever the catch word was, and we had to get close to God. And I'm using the word revival. I'm sure there's, you know, we've all had different phrases for what we were trying to do. I'm going to give you the key. I'm going to give you the answer right now. So you can stop chasing. Don't read any more books about it. I'm going to tell you right now. Because in my travels, before I ended up going into the dirtiest, worst places of planet Earth for a living, before that, I was going to the conferences, and I met with people. I mean, I've had family barbecues at Billy Graham's house. And, you know, if there's a guy that you want to hang out with, if you're gonna figure out how to get close with God, that's he'd be near the top of the list, I would think. There was some dude in India that the story was he'd walk through hospitals and, like, limbs would grow back and crazy stuff. I got to sit down and meet with him for a couple of days. It was wild. It was absolutely wild sitting with these people. I got to sit and spend a bunch of time with a person that worked directly with Mother Teresa. I mean, these are some people that I looked up to my whole life. And I thought, if you're going to get close to God, that's how you get close to God, right? Like, the spiritual people. I'm going to tell you a secret that I learned. When that earthquake happened in Haiti, now, Woodlean was already in Dominican Republic, so this is actually not anything to do with Woodlean. I took a team, Canadians and Americans, just a half a dozen of us or so. JetBlue flew us down. They gave us whatever we wanted on the plane. They gave us cargo, whatever we needed. We went in with a bunch of supplies, and we were one of the first teams to show up after the Haiti earthquake to do rescue and recovery or whatever you want to. I mean, it was a mess, okay? 315,000 people died like that. Think about that just for a second. It was 42 degrees on the coolest day that we were there for a week. You got to just get your head around the scene. And we walked around and we met with all the media people that were there, and Anderson Cooper was there and all these people, and they were all doing their reports about what's going to happen next and all this stuff. And we went into the slum of the slums. And the reason we went right away is because we had built 2 orphanages in Haiti and we couldn't get them on the phone. We didn't know the phone lines were down. We just assumed there was, like, you know, 80 dead orphans that we had to contend with. We didn't know. Luckily, our orphanages were completely untouched by the earthquake, so that was good news. But we're like, we're here. Let's go do something. Let's go do some work. So we went out and we started looking for things to do. And the last day we were in Haiti after the earthquake, we went to a spot and we saw this dude. And he stood out because he was standing like this. And when I tell you it was a mess, I mean, I don't know how to explain. The city was built with the infrastructure for 50,000 people and 3.8 million people were living in it. Like, it was all cinder block construction, and it's like someone came and just went boom, like Lego. Everything came down, and anyone that was inside a building was buried. And this man was standing back. His name was Pierre. He's standing like this, and there's 3 guys, because it's on a steep hill, and he's looking at this rubble, and you can tell he'd been digging. His pant legs were a mess, his hands were a mess, he's got dust all over him, but he's just kind of taking a break. And he's got 3 dudes that are digging. And they're digging. And I'm like, this doesn't make sense. He's the only guy that I've seen yet that's kind of standing back. All the foreigners were doing that, standing back with their cameras. But he's the only Haitian guy that wasn't right into it. So we had our translator go over and find out what was going on. It So we're maybe, I want to say 4 days after the actual quake. And he went out for milk. He's a single dad. Lost his wife to diabetes a couple years before. He's got his sister living in the house with him, his 3-year-old daughter and his 5-year-old daughter. It was dinner time. He slipped out to buy milk. 10 minutes, 15 minutes gone. As he's walking back, the whole city just crumbled. Is everything he had. His 3-year-old, his 5-year-old, and his sister, the only relatives in his life, were in that house and were buried. He came out of it. He had a car. You would never get it on the road in this country. It was a piece of junk, but he sold it. He found everything he had that he could find, and he sold it, and he hired these 3 guys to dig. Liquidated everything, even gave them a promissory note, like, I'm going to pay you more over the next few months. You've got to dig. And they were digging now for 4 days. So we came over to Pierre, and we said, it was me, and our team had kind of dispersed, but me and another guy, also a pretty big guy, and we were ready. We were ready for, like, we were ready to work. And we said, can we help you? And he looks at us, and he says, no. And I've been doing humanitarian work for 12 years or something at the time, and I have never heard no. I have never heard no. And I asked the translator, I said, did you get that right? And, you know, no in Creole is no. So I think I got it. And he said, let me talk to him. And Pierre looks at him, and he says, I just sold my car. I sold everything I had. I borrowed money. And I'm now in debt future to these 3 men. Tell your friends I can't afford to hire them. He thought we were going to charge him to help. And let me tell you, I'm not telling you that story for any other reason other than to come back to this quest that we have to get up in God's face and to experience the presence of God and to get into that revival place. Because I'm telling you, all the places I just told you I've been, all the people I've met, all the conferences and all the stuff that's happened, the spiritual stuff, when we got on our hands and our knees, and we started, there's no shovels. You got to understand, this is giant pieces of concrete, and we're digging, we're with our bare hands trying to just pull it apart, and we can hear movement inside, and we're digging. I will tell you right now, as God is my witness, I have never felt God like I did there. I've been in a million churches. I've been in a million's a stretch, but a lot. And conferences and all that stuff. That's why that verse makes sense in the book of James. Pure, pure religion is this, taking care of widows and taking care of orphans. If you want to find, listen, I'm not saying God doesn't show up in church. Don't get me wrong. Okay, don't leave and say I said that. Because we do the work, we worship, we pray. I got ADD all over the place. I can't keep my attention span for 40 minutes. But we work at it, and we press in, and we do what we do, and it's all great. But I'm telling you, if you want a fast track, if you want the I don't know what you want to call it, the easy route to get right up in the face of God, get yourself on a plane, find yourself the poorest country on planet Earth. Get a widow and an orphan and go help them. You will never experience the heart of God like you do on that day. I promise you. And we tapped into something, and that earthquake scene. I walked away. And I'm like, I don't even know what I feel right now. Because read about all the historic, the giant revivals all through history. They all happen in places where people don't have anything. Why? Because we can get bogged down with our stuff. We spend our lives looking for spirituality, looking for God. And he gave us the answer right there in James. You want religion? You want religion that I like? Because there's all kinds of religions that I like. I like the ones that don't require a lot of work, first of all. And they have all the benefits. Those are good ones. But God says, if you want a religion that I like, widows, orphans, you take care of them. There's a verse in Proverbs that says, if you give to the poor, you lend to the Lord. If you're going to borrow money to somebody, borrow it to the maker of the universe. He's got collateral. He'll pay you back. It's not a bad verse. I'm gonna end with this. I said that three times already. A friend of mine started a church in BC years and years and years ago. Man, I am old. And the idea of the church, it was a house church, and he started with 10 people. And he said, the goal is we're going to send 100 missionaries overseas, and we're going to finance them. And they got their 10 people, and they were all kind of helping and giving money, and they, you know, they sent their first missionary and their second missionary. And the vision was so infectious, it caught on. Then they had 20 people. Then they had 40 people. And then they sent another missionary. And then they had 100 people. And then, this is not anonymous. It's Wesley and Stacy Campbell, if you know who they are. Good friends of mine, and Wesley would tell this story. This is not confidential. And they hit 200 people. And he's like, whoa, we need to really ramp this up. And they did. They got their 100 missionaries, 200 people in the church. They're financing 100 missionaries overseas. But then, 200 people, we need a building. They got a building. Oh, the building needs a parking lot. We got to pave the parking lot. We need a worship pastor. We need an assistant worship pastor. We need a children's pastor. We need a nursery. We need carpet for the nursery. We need ceiling fans. We need air conditioning. And there's 800 people. Now you need an overflow. Oh, now there's 1,000 people. We need another building. That other building is no good. Now we need more carpet, more pavement, more nursery, more overflow. The worship pastor needs 3 more assistants. They need new guitars and new keyboards. Now there's 1,500 people. Before you knew it, there was 3,000 people in the church. And Wesley stayed at my house in Hamilton when he was pastoring a church of 3,000 people. And he said, listen, Vaden. And he was a big inspiration to me. And he said, listen, when we had 200 people in our church, we sent 100 missionaries overseas and we financed them. We got 3,000 people in the church. We still have 100 missionaries and we're financing them. And this is what he said. He said, the tail started wagging the dog. Please. Faith without works is dead. Let's take what we do in here and get it out there. We have to get it out there. If we don't get it out there, it's no good to anybody in here. This is for us, and this is great. And we cherish the moments we have in here. Our calling, our mandate is to take this somewhere else. That's why we're here. Dave, I'm done. I got to stop talking, man. I talk too much. Yeah. That's an amen right there.
Thanks, Vaden.